Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I was thinking about when I first met Jim on this campus, and I had come here in 89, and I was building a lab over in Mayor Hall in 1990, and there wasn't much in the lab, and it was on the fourth floor, and I was struggling to try to put some things together, and there was some water started dripping down from the ceiling into my lab, and I thought, no, this won't do. So I went screaming upstairs to take the head off whoever was leaking water up in the fifth floor of Mayor Hall. It was Jim Arnold. And so rather than take his head off, we chatted for a couple of hours. And it was just a wonderful experience to hear him, to have that much time with him, to hear what he was up to and doing. As you all know, he was the founding chair of the department, and UCSD is celebrating, as most of you know, celebrating their 50th anniversary. And a few of you, as I look around, not many of you, but a few of you, aren't 50 yet. And so you'll say, well, so what? And my response to you is that if it weren't for the creativity, the innovation, and the pioneering nature of Jim Arnold and his colleagues during that period, you wouldn't be here today, because this campus wouldn't be what it is today. And I have worked on various campuses over my lifetime, and I will say that this is really an innovative, pioneering place. We're celebrating that, and it's in large part because of people like Jim Arnold. He was elected to the National Academy. We've celebrated a few people from this campus being elected to the National Academy this week. Jim Arnold was elected in 1964 to the National Academy. And so so this is the kind of people that created this campus. And we should always have a special part in our heart for those people that created this truly innovative campus. And we should protect it as well as we can. Now, I'm going to introduce a speaker who's not on this campus, but he has worked here a fair bit. He's worked here before this campus existed, but the parent of the campus, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, was here. And our speaker, Buford Price, is a professor of physics at UC Berkeley. In fact, I have an office in Burge Hall on the third floor, and until some time ago, he had an office just down the hall from me. So we would see each other. I was doing another job at the time, but I came in the evenings and on Saturdays to keep my students under control. And Buford was there too, keeping his students under control, as near as I can tell. He has had and continues to have a marvelous career. He worked with Jim Arnold in the 60s, looking at microscopic fission tracks that could date things. And I benefited from that years later, because I did some experiments using millipores and things like that I'm told it came from the sort of things that they did by etching out these tracks. He is currently associated with the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector. And during this work, he showed that micron-sized bacteria can live in liquid veins throughout the depths of several kilometers in glacial ice. And that these bacteria survive, I think, thousands of years. He's going to tell us this. I'll wait and see what he tells us. But it's breathtaking work, and it's a pleasure to introduce our colleague and my colleague, Professor Buford Price.
You know, I was just thinking, I decided I'd better prepare a few bits of notes about Jim, because I remember when I was dean and they gave me a retirement party, I had worked really very hard and written down all kinds of important things that I wanted to say at the retirement. And I forgot the piece of paper, and I started to speak, and it's the only time that I've ever been so totally at a loss that I had to say, excuse me, I just don't remember anything. It's too overwhelming an event. So I do have a couple of things here. I did meet Jim in around 1962. I was a relative newcomer to General Electric Research Laboratory, and at that time I was interested in meteorites and ultimately in the ability to get lunar samples back and to do various things with them, which I'll tell you a little bit about. Dean Tiemens asked me if I would talk for a few minutes about some of the very early work that I did. So I'll have about a third of my talk about the good old days. Well, Jim was doing gamma ray spectroscopy and looking at radioactivity in meteorites and ultimately in the moon. He was one of the four horsemen, the four horsemen being the real key figures who advised NASA on how to set up the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and whether life was going to kill all of civilization or not, and important things like that. And he and Paul Gast and Jerry Wasserberg and my senior partner, Bob Walker, the four horsemen, had dinner at the White House. And I think Von Braun may also have been there. One of the things that Jim did was to speculate about whether there is existing water in dark craters and underground in the surface of the moon, and whether one could imagine setting up permanent colonies on the moon. And that was one of his great interests, populating the moon and maybe ultimately other planets, and how to get there, transportation vehicles. He was director of CalSpace, and I have to tell you a little bit about CalSpace, because I thought it was outrageous that our current governor, when he was in his 20s, I think he was in his late 20s, had a science astronaut whose name will come to me in a moment.
Rusty
Swikert, who said, look, what you should do, Governor Brown, is tell the people of tell the researchers of California that they need to get into space research. Can you imagine that? And so he said, create an institute to do space research. And so after realizing that there would be money involved, I was on the committee. Jim Arnold became the director. And the most important thing we did in those old days was to set up these mini grants, of which I got two, one of which led to the kilometer cube under ice neutrino observatory at the South Pole. I think we got about $8,000. It currently cost $250 million. That was pretty good leverage. And then I got money to look for weakly interacting massive particles called WIMPs in little crystals of mica, another $8,000. So let's start. So here's a book that I wrote with Bob Walker and Bob Fleischer. Bob was 4 years older than me, and he came to me one day and said, I've just come back from Harwell Atomic Research Laboratory in England, where they've discovered that if you irradiate mica crystals with fission fragments from neutron-induced fission in a reactor, you can see them in an electron microscope. What he didn't say was that they fade in about 3 seconds. And that was one small problem. He was, of course, interested in finding in meteorites and in the lunar samples minerals that might retain some information about the high-energy history of the early days of the formation of the solar system. And there were many good ideas there. And by a miracle, it all worked. We figured out a way to preserve the tracks, which in fact were preserved in as long as you didn't irradiate them in an electron microscope. And this story goes back to Rutherford. Over on the left are what he called pleochroic halos in mica. Now, this has been etched, and I'll tell you how I know that in just a moment. But what you see are rings of color of very well-defined radii, which are the radiation-induced color centers induced by emitted alpha particles of different energy from a little nugget of something that looks white in the center, which might be a tiny inclusion of zircon or some other mineral, which collects uranium and thorium in its lattice. And so Rutherford actually estimated from the range of the alpha particles what some of the energies in the alpha particle chain were. And the little white dots are our discovery that if you etch for just the right amount of time, you can see not only the fission fragments, which are shown up here, I'll come to this in a minute, the one in the middle, but you can see the radiation damage left when an alpha particle goes this way and the recoiling daughter is kicked backwards a little bit, and it doesn't go very far, but it produces the little white track. In the middle, what you see is in an optical microscope, if you zoom in, take away the little zircon, this is terrible. I didn't realize the contrast was so poor. You could see in the original several rings of different radii here. Okay, so here is where the zircon inclusion was, and these white lines are the result of spontaneous fission of uranium-238, which is the only surviving natural radioactivity in which there's a major decay mode into fission. And so this led us to the technique called fission track dating. But the discovery of how to keep these tracks from disappearing was you use the standard tool of what was then material science studies of dislocations in lithium fluoride and other crystals. You use hydrofluoric acid, dip the mica in it, and you etch out a hole, and I'll show you in fine detail on an atomic structure what that hole should look like in just a moment. And over here, this is a very high magnification, so here's 1 micron, and this is 10 microns here. So these are from a much smaller little nugget of something that's rich in uranium that has the spontaneous fission tracks. And here, taken decades later at Darmstadt, where they have an accelerator that produces GEV, uranium, and lead ions. So there's a head-on track of a uranium ion here and a lead ion here in different minerals. And you see that around the outside you have atomic resolution of the perfect crystal structure. And right here everything is just beat to death. All the atoms are disturbed. And you can imagine why hydrofluoric acid attacks the core of that disordered region. It's chemically very reactive. And the same thing over here. Now, at General Electric, Bob Walker and Bob Fleischer and I agreed that we would all publish all papers alphabetically, and we could come up with any idea we wanted to as long as it was on a general theme. And so that left each of us the option to explore crazy ideas, because he could get his name on other papers as well. So at that time, and this goes way, way back, plate tectonics was still not universally accepted. In fact, the president of some international geophysics union, in his retiring address, said that he, for one, thought the jury was still out about whether there was a tectonic plate movement. But here in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, you have fresh lava coming up and going that way on one side of this two plates coming together and on the other side going that way. So they start with molten material, and when they hit the ocean water, they freeze, and they freeze in all of the spontaneous fission tracks from the uranium impurities and provide you with a clock. And all you need to date is two things. You need to know you need to know the amount of uranium that's in the material, and from the spontaneous fission decay rate, you can calculate per year how many tracks are formed, provided you know the uranium concentration. So you can derive the uranium concentration by a simple method of putting the material in a reactor and inducing new tracks, fresh tracks, and then taking the ratio of the two. And it all worked out at temperatures below the temperature at which that particular mineral starts to undergo track fading, loss of the uranium fission tracks. And so what do we see here? Very close to this boundary between the two plates, you get an age which took Bob Fleischer weeks to come up with because he had to scan such a huge amount of material to get such a young age. 200,000 years, 300,000 years. So the age is monotonically increasing that way and also that way. And there were many other interesting examples that Fleischer was able to do. Now I'm going to jump much further into the later period of our collaboration. Actually, this was after I had moved to Berkeley. But with samples from the moon, and in particular from several cores into the lunar soil and one Russian core, we were able to discover that there is an effect which we called gardening. And the gardening is the result of micrometeorites constantly hitting the rock and breaking it up into tiny particles that got smaller and smaller and were churned. In fact, we were talking about suntanning of the samples. And what you see here are barely visible, very short and incredibly small in diameter, not fission tracks, but iron nuclear tracks from the sun. So these were these permitted us to make the discovery that there's a mechanism in solar flares that greatly favors the acceleration of high atomic number particles over low atomic number. And furthermore, the fact that they're at all depths suggests that this process of creation of soil and stirring of it has many implications, one of which in the present day is that if you're going to look for life on Mars, don't look in the top meter or two, because the micrometeorites are still churning the Mars soil and exposing every little piece to solar ultraviolet radiation, which kills cells, probably would kill cells. Now, this shows us what Bob was talking about, the invention of what we called the nuclepore filter. Its origins are obscure to everybody but a few of us who invented it. And if you ask essentially any biologist in the world how nuclepore filters are made, they're clueless. In fact, one prominent biologist told her student, oh, they're made by getting a long roll of this polycarbonate tape and punching holes. Now, if you want to make a filter that is small enough to collect everything and let viruses through, you need 0.02 microns for the diameter, and you need about 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 holes. So that would be a long bit of work to try to make a virus-size nuclepore filter. When I told her, she was quite interested in... And I'm using it in my current research, I must say. I pay a dollar per filter like this, and every biology department stores it. I don't want to spend too much time on the good old days, but this is an example of how one of my best students, the one who guided Gerardo, who's sitting in the audience here, to his PhD, I had brought a Chinese woman back on an exchange with the NSF program. We had developed, through her skill in chemistry, a way of improving a kind of glass that I had already realized was going to be very good for flying in space. There was no danger of any plastic outgassing and aging. Barium phosphate by itself, as a binary compound, was quite good at being able to distinguish different elements in the periodic table at relativistic speeds. And when we fine-tuned it with chemistry, we got down to a resolution of about a third of a charge unit for highly relativistic particles up to uranium. And you can see we had a microscope with the capability of ellipse fitting, and I won't go into the details, but we had a lot of fun with the Soviet cosmonauts, training them on how to put these glass detectors on the outside of the Mir station. And the first thing they said was, you simply are clueless about how difficult it is for a cosmonaut suited up to handle some dinky little control like you've built. So you've got to rebuild the control for something that a big hand can handle. Let me jump now from the origins of the biggest detector ever built anywhere. I'll show that in the next transparency. We call it Ice Cube. This was a very modest version of it, which we got started with the $8,000 from CalSpace. And Francis Halzen had come up, he's a theoretical physicist at Wisconsin, he'd come up with the idea that the failing project called DUMAND, Deep Underwater Muon and Neutrino Observatory, that was supposed to be in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Hawaii, was not working because the Navy was having a problem with dangling many strings that had phototubes on it all the way down, 6 kilometers down to the ocean floor. And Francis said, maybe we should try putting it in ice. And so Westfall, who was doing his thesis work, flying a balloon around and around the South Pole to collect cosmic rays, said, well, I will visit Barclay Cam, a famous glaciologist, and use his hot water holes that he's made in the ice and put phototubes in one hole and a laser beam in another one and measure whether the ice is clear or not. And the drill failed that season. But 6 months later, Tim Miller and Bob Morse went to the other antipode, to Greenland, and came up with a very nice result, which was that if you just use muons, that you know the arrival rate, and measure the counting rate in each of three phototubes that are in drill holes, you can estimate the transparency of the ice from the counting rate. And it looked encouraging, and that led to the birth of this. So this, we had the dedication 2 weeks ago up in Wisconsin. There were all kinds of celebrations of the successful completion under budget of this $250 million observatory. The cross-section is a square kilometer, and the instrumentation begins here and goes to there. That's another kilometer. If you do anything up in here, it becomes a diffusion chamber rather than a tracking chamber because the bubbles scatter too much of the light from the muons that are the disintegration products of the neutrinos that we were looking for. So this, I could talk for an hour about that, and I won't. I'll come to now the gist of the talk, and you can see a theme that I seem to be in love with tiny objects. So ranging from my thesis, which was on the growth of zinc and cadmium whiskers, single crystal whiskers, to the search for what is causing the chlorophyll fluorescence when we operate a detector to look in solid ice at the National Ice Core Laboratory from different regions of Greenland and Antarctica. So I'm going to get to that in a moment, but my first recognition as somebody who, though admittedly a physicist, came up with the idea that finally solved the problem of how microbes can get food, can live, can get bodybuilding elements. So the solution, most biologists never have a course in phase diagrams or chemistry. In fact, they also don't have a course in physics or geology. And I would encourage anybody who's still a student to try to take courses outside of biology because you'll come up with more ideas if you're broader. So with that little caveat, here are the two bugs. There's one there and there's one there. And these are the result of the same process that happens if you're living in the north and your sidewalk is covered with ice and you want to walk without slipping. You sprinkle salt. And salt forms a binary compound with water. And the freezing point is lowered by about 22 degrees if you have the optimum ratio of salt to water. And so it melts the ice. And here in ice at minus 50, there are a number of compounds, including sulfuric acid, which, when mixed with ice, lower the freezing point so that a microbe that can tolerate two normal sulfuric acid can happily live and do bodybuilding and get energy and move. It can't reproduce. There's just not enough energy at minus 40 or so to replicate. And I'll show you why we know that some of them are alive in just a moment. So after getting everybody in the biology community who works on microbes in ice to accept this, and even to do clever experiments with cryotomes in which you slice and then image and see that, in fact, the microbes are living in veins. I had to come up with some other habitats, particularly for those cells that are much too big to fit into veins. And this is my favorite. Here, in solid ice, there is, for physical chemistry reasons, always a monolayer or two of unfrozen water that separates two different regions. Here is a cell, and here is solid ice. And they can simply sit and wait. And at some low temperature like minus 30, molecules that are less than about five atoms on side at low temperature can diffuse enough to provide the ingredients for redox reactions that will keep aerobes alive. And furthermore, you can have within some short distance of each other strict aerobes and strict anaerobes that can coexist because the rate of reaction is so slow that if, say, a molecule of oxygen reaches the wall of a methanogen, the methanogen can handle through certain enzymes, can counteract the poisonous effect. It can't reproduce, but it couldn't reproduce anyway, but it can live. So here are the sites that we've been studying. Two in Greenland. GISP is Greenland Ice Sheet Project number 2, and it goes down 3,000 and some meters. And I'll show you what happens there that looks very similar to what's happening in deep boreholes over here. So these are the sites that we've collected ice from. The National Ice Core Laboratory at Denver has NSF support to store something like 20,000 meters of ice from different locations. And they're going to get a large batch of additional ice from this project, which has just reached a successful completion of its drilling to 3,300 meters. And so we'll be getting samples from deep down. We already have them from higher up. So this is one device that we invented, which we call modestly the Berkeley fluorescence spectrometer. And it has a state-of-the-art deep ultraviolet laser pointing down, so it sends beams that you would think would kill cells. They're in the deep ultraviolet. They love it. They don't care at all. There is a solid-state process that takes place in solid ice that enables them to survive without being destroyed. And so here's me, a graduate student, and my senior collaborator, Ryan Bay. You translate on this stage, the ice has been sliced, polished a bit. It passes under the laser beam. You get 1,400 spectra per 2 minutes, and then you replace the ice with another batch. There are 7 phototubes, and we wish we had 10 or 20. It can just measure the spectrum of the tryptophan amino acid, which fluoresces at an emission maximum of around 320 nanometers. So we need several points. 4 of the phototubes are devoted to making sure that we've got tryptophan. A fifth one, which has turned out to be the most important thing that we have done, is to measure chlorophyll, which is in the bright red. And a 7th one, we can look for certain ash minerals that signify a volcanic eruption. And we've looked at something like 150 eruptions and compared them at different parts in the world. And in fact, my colleague Ryan Bay submitted a paper to Nature in which he showed the amazing correlation between the time of a volcanic eruption and an abrupt change of global temperature by several degrees. And they rejected it finally after having it reviewed over and over again, and their final decision was, you can't yet tell us which way the causality went. Come back when you've decided whether eruptions cause climate change or vice versa. And we still don't know. We can make arguments, physical arguments, for either case. So now I'm going to show you 2 zooming ins. Here what we have is the chlorophyll signal from about 100 meters depth, and these are all data points from several different locations in the polar regions, and I just put them together because there's no significant difference between Greenland and Antarctica. And there's a trend downward. The lowest point we have here is at 2,300 meters, and we'll eventually go to there, but I think there's no big deal about that additional 700 meters. It's clear that it's declining, and the question is why? Is it because the chlorophyll is finally decomposing? I don't think so, because the decomposition product, pheophyton, has about the same emission peak as chlorophyll. So it's unlikely to be doing that. These, of course, are in total darkness, and it probably is simply that some of the cells are dead. Now I'm going to start to make a chain of arguments that lead me to the final conclusion of what I think is the most important thing that we have seen so far in biology in looking at all of these ice samples. So the first thing is, if you don't average over a meter or so at a time, but you look at every single point, and there are zillions of points here, and you do a spline fit, you discover that, in fact, there are peaks and valleys, and the distance between adjacent peaks is equal to 1 year. Now, we know that from the phase, we know that the peaks occur in the local summertime. There is a satellite which does ocean color spectrometry. It's called CWIFS. And in the Antarctic, the peaks of chlorophyll in the ocean surface occur in the January, the Antarctic summer, and in the northern part. We haven't done the phase yet, but I would guess that the peaks also occur in the local summertime, which would be July. Now, the swings between maximum and minimum are only about a 30% difference, and so it's not a very strong effect, which might be explained by the fact that they're coming from various distances, and some of them travel all the way from a somewhat more temperate latitude where there's not as big a change in the production of these cyanobacteria and their chlorophyll. I'm coming to the topic of the cyanobacteria now. So one of the things that, as a physicist, I searched the literature to answer the question, is it reasonable that wind and waves could eject small cells from the surface of the ocean surrounding Antarctica or the Arctic Ocean surrounding Greenland and keep them up in the air long enough that they could make it all the way by being blown by winds into somewhere in Antarctica where they're deposited on snow and then sitting there, and over the millennia, more and more snow compresses them, and they get older and older. The answer is yes, it is possible in a narrow range of sizes. This is the aerosol plot, which says that at sizes bigger than about 5 microns or so, the survival time is short because of Stokes' law of settling of an object of greater density in an object of lighter density. So that cuts off the big ones. And the small ones, viruses, for example, or microbes smaller than, say, a tenth of a micron, are moving very rapidly, and they collide and accumulate, and then they fall out. Or they're rained out. They're rained out. So this is a perfect explanation for how we get bacteria that are in the size range a tenth to 1 micron. And now let's look with a microscope to see if, in fact, the chlorophyll is coming from individual cells that aren't just splattered into a disintegrated mess of free chlorophyll, but in fact have integrity. So here's the first one. This is from the West Antarctic Ice Sheet Divide. And so because the concentration of cells that do make it all the way from the ocean into the ice is small, you use centrifuges to concentrate them. And we have ultimately decided that the two genera that we are studying in great detail are really picocyanobacteria. The two genera are Prochlorococcus and Senecococcus, which were thought until fairly recently to love warm ocean water and to be found at latitudes shorter than 40 degrees north or south. That seems to be true of Prochlorococcus generally. They're more sensitive to temperature, and I'll show you data in just a minute. Senecococcus we've found, and so have shipboard experiments found, all the way up into the Arctic region. Now, the Prochlorococcus was a daunting problem for me to solve, but it was solved 25 years ago by Sally Chisholm at MIT, who took a shipboard instrument called a flow cytometer on board the ship, and even though the lifetime against bleaching of Prochlorococcus was measured in 1 second, 2 seconds, if you use this instrument, the flow cytometer, you can see them before they photobleach. Now here, so it was another experiment in which we took a similar set of cells from the same ice, and we, after concentrating them, we decided, let's see what happens if we reproduce the experiment that the cells had to go through when they landed on Antarctic ice. We put them into our freezer for several weeks at minus 30, and then used a stain, which is a mixture of two chemicals, and it's called a live dead test. And it's now been automated so simply that it was fun for us to do this. And we did a lot of experiments in which we measured the ratio of green ones, and the you can see, I would call them orange, and in fact with greater fidelity in the color quality, these look orange to me on the screen, and they look kind of yellow-orange here. But take the ratio of the two, and it says that something like half of the cells were still alive after the shock of going from room temperature to minus 30. And so here was an experiment with cultures, and friends in biology have provided us with a number of cultures which so greatly concentrate the amount of cells of one specific species or even strain that you can do a lot of quick experiments, including these studies of live-dead tests. So here at minus 30, essentially every cell is still undergoing the green signal of being alive, the Senecococcus. And here in the Prochlorococcus, you see that there are about 1, 2, 3, 4 cells that I can see now are dead and only one or two that are alive. So it's more delicate. And that is consistent with the fact that the Senecococcus are found at greater latitudes than the Prochlorococcus. So remember those two names because they are so important to us as human beings. They are producing, are causing oxygen to be produced. About half of the oxygen in the atmosphere is attributable to these very abundant submicron-sized cells in the ocean. So here's a fairly recent experiment. Zwirgelmeier et al., one of their cruise tracks was up to the island of Svalbard. At this latitude, we've got 80 degrees. Down it's about 70. Over here, they're only looking at Senecococcus in this study. The greatest concentration is about two orders of magnitude lower than it is near the equator or in the Sargasso Sea, but this they are seen as far north as 72 degrees. Over here, this gives you more detail, Doolittle et al., same year. Let's skip Pico eukaryotes. No, let's not. These are tiny cells of which the most prominent members are Ostreococcus. And they're as small as a few tenths of a micron, and they are by far the smallest non-bacteria, eukaryotes, found in the oceans, and they're very abundant. And for some strange reason, we haven't found them in any of our experiments, so maybe they don't survive the plunging onto the frozen ice. Don't know yet. So Prochlorococcus, you can see it's falling dramatically with temperature of ocean, and by the time you get to, this is 10 degrees, it's off scale. They're not enough to be seen in ocean collections. Senecococcus, on the other hand, you collect them all the way down to about minus 2 degrees. Now, so I just mentioned Ostreococcus, this curious eukaryote. And here we also did the live dead stain and found that up to 100% of them did not survive. And so maybe that's one reason why we haven't yet located them. Pelagibacter is the fourth of the tiny cells that are so abundant. So here, this gives you a detailed explanation. Their name is Pelagibacter ubique, and anybody who knows Latin knows that that means they're everywhere. In fact, they're all the way down to Antarctica and all the way up to Greenland. And why don't we see them? They're the right size. The emission is at about 700 instead of 670, but we should be able to see that. But when you look, it fades instantly. No, it's not that it fades. It's just that in at room temperature, when you're doing an experiment to measure their fluorescence, there is a solid-state physics process that's non-radiative de-excitation. So this, so far, unless you cool them to liquid nitrogen, nobody has been successful in detecting their fluorescence by standard techniques at room temperature. But this is not. This is beginning to be a standard technique. Flow cytometry is very powerful, and I love it. What you have up here, you inject in a sheath a fluid which is sucked downward at high speed, and you have a sample that's injected here in which all of the cells are hydrodynamically focused along the center of this tube by the sheath fluid, and they pass by several sets of lasers with different roles and different wavelengths. This one is simply injecting a beam, and whenever a cell passes through that beam, the laser beam scatters. And you have detectors at right angles and at forward directions, and the signal intensity measures the size, or a number which is proportional to the size. So that is very important to see whether we are, in fact, looking at these pico cyanobacteria or something else, or maybe a piece of mineral dirt which got in there. And then down here, as the cells passed electrostatic plates, you can do sorting into vessels underneath if you choose. If you see from the signal up here that they have the right fluorescence, then you can collect them. So now you have roughly 100% of, say, Prochlorococcus here and Senecococcus there. Then you can go and do genomics, which I've got to do, because no physicist is going to have a paper accepted by a reputable journal who doesn't have the genome and is claiming, just on the basis of a two-parameter plot, red versus orange, that he's discovered that there are Prochlorococcus as far south as Antarctica. So cultures, I said, were valuable, and here is a good example. So we're plotting with that multiple laser flow cytometry system the logarithm of the red fluorescence of chlorophyll and the log of phycoerythrin, which is another fluor, which is has an orange emission around 590, both of which are earmarks of cyanobacteria. And so cultures of this smallest of the eukaryotes, Ostreococcus, has a lot of chlorophyll in it, even though it's tiny, and it needs that chlorophyll to extract enough energy from sunlight to keep going. Prochlorococcus, which is from shallow ocean waters, doesn't need as much chlorophyll to extract enough sunlight from the sun, which isn't absorbed very fast. Senecococcus is up here, and if you collect a culture and look at it from deep ocean waters, Prochlorococcus is shifted up here because you need more chlorophyll for sunlight to penetrate down to 100 or 200 meters. And then it's important to measure size, and so this one maps in size over to the smallest scattering, so the smallest cell size. The largest is the Senecococcus, which goes over here and is pinned against the right-hand side. And these are log scales, and the Ostreococcus there. So now I'm just going to flash a whole bunch of flow cytograms past you. to show that just about any fistful of ice from either the Arctic or the Antarctic, the Greenland or Antarctica, has roughly the same stuff in it if you first pass it through a micron-sized filter to cut out junk. And by junk, I would define that as any cells that don't define what I'm looking for, meaning eukaryotes, fungi, algae, mineral dust particles that are big. So one micron helps clean it up. And up in here, I'm just repeating for a culture where you would expect the Seneca coccus to fall, and then some dead cells or some contaminating Prochlorococcus down there. But that's where we expect the signal to be most intense. And here is the Prochlorococcus culture for the shallow ocean water. So this is R13, and this is R14, and on up beyond. So now I'm just going to flash down waste divide, 26 meters. Here's noise. This is the noise that we reject. So Prochlorococcus here, Seneca coccus running diagonally up there. Same thing here. This had a rather unusually large concentration, and it is not falling off monotonically with depth. It's just whatever in that grab bag you were lucky enough to catch on a particular week or so of collection from the aerosols carrying them from the ocean surface. So you take a look at these. These are all of these are quite clearly showing at least the Prochlorococcus. This is sort of a rather weak signal. Here, there are only two or three possible Seneca coccus and a small number of Prochlorococcus, but this is just statistics. It's actually not statistics, it's meteorology. It's whatever was carrying them from the ocean that day. And over here, we had gotten from the European glaciologists samples from the oldest ice that's yet been pulled up, Dome Sea. This is from a shallow region. They wouldn't give me their valuable ice, which went all the way back almost a million years. And maybe I'll go back to them now that we found that we did not disagree with them. You see, we only had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 cells in the same volume that over here we had several hundred. And they told me we weren't going to find any cells. So, okay, I can say that they were right. So just a couple more of these. This is quite interesting here to compare shallow ice in the Greenland Ice Sheet Project at 80 meters here and at 3,000 meters here. And if you weren't reading the label, you wouldn't know which was which. How much evolution has taken place in this time? This is 150,000 years. To me, I would say you can't tell any dramatic changes through mutations of the distribution of at least the two colors during 150,000 years. And so just going through here, a couple more from very deep down in the Greenland ice sheet. It's interesting that you do see several strains from time to time. This may have one that's a minority strain that's separated from there, both being Seneca coccus. Here's another that has two strains. And I'm going to show you what I think is my favorite here. It shows a really nicely separated a group of green points, which I call low light adapted. They're very happy with, they have to have a lot more chlorophyll and phycoerythrin in order to survive deeper down where not much sunlight penetrates. And then here's the higher light Seneca coccus in red, and over here are Prochlorococcus. And then in this plot, again, of the red color versus side scatter, you see we've every one of these flow cytograms, if you weren't trying to jam so many pictures into one field of view, is supposed to have beads in it that show you roughly the sizes. So half a micron in that region, 1 micron in that region. More of the same. And that's the same example where we have two Seneca coccus strains. So, this is from East Antarctica where some intrepid Americans and Norwegians did narrow drilling and collected ice, and we got some of it. So now I'm coming to the most difficult topic, and my talks with biologists have not assured me that it's going to be doable or easy. So let's go through what I thought might be possible eventually. So we've talked about the fact that they somehow migrate in small numbers and can be found. Seneca caucus, without any question, are present at high latitudes, and we claim that we have found Prochlorococcus also at high latitudes. And then we find that we have the idea that with flow cytometry we can do the sorting into two little buckets, giving biologists these cells which are enriched in Prochlorococcus, giving them samples that are enriched in Prochlorococcus and Seneca caucus to do quantitative polymerase chain reaction biology, and ultimately to do single cell genomics and to look for mutations from one time period to another. But that was my simplistic idea. Collect, say, 10 samples going back 150,000 years in the north and in the south and see if you can detect evolution. Now, the generation time is about half a day. In 150,000 years, you've got 100 million generations. Is that big? Is that a large number? Or is it not large enough? Humans have undergone, 1 million or 10 million years of evolution with a turnover time of 30 years, only a few tens of thousands of generations. E. coli, there have been studies that have followed their mutations for about 80,000 generations. So we could go much, much further with one problem. You can start with a single cell and clone it, and in 100 or so petri dishes, you start with exactly the same genome. And so you can then look at evolution and mutations over tens of thousands of generations from that laboratory experiment. But if you're depending upon what's coming up out of the ocean and you look at a grab bag of ice, it could have so many strains in it that there's no hope of seeing evolution as you go back in time. And we just don't know the answer to that. Are there tricks that we can pull? And so that is the stage that we're at. And I've had already two good conversations today at Scripps with biologists who've made critical suggestions to me. It's a great pleasure to have been invited to come here to honor Jim, and I'm looking forward to coming again.
You said you began earlier in your career with the industrial laboratory and General Electric.
Yeah.
Also known as Bell Labs. And was that just the time of the 60s when there was all this money and we'd get a bunch of smart folks and turn them loose?
You're absolutely right. Bell was much better at that and tolerated these free-thinking scientists much longer, but they finally gave up. General Electric had different divisions within one building, and I was in one of the three that hired people with the hope that their PhD theses were in something that could lead to something of interest to General Electric, but were given free rein after they got there, and that disappeared. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really tough on a time scale of a few decades to justify investment in terms of products. We invented three things that I'm proud of. We got $25 a piece for turning over the patents. One was the biology filters that everybody knows about, but nobody knows who invented. And second was fission track dating. And study the studies of thermochronology, where you want to measure the rate at which the Himalayas are being formed and the Alps are being formed. And there you depend upon the fact that down low, when they're just very hot, the tracks are not formed. But if you have different minerals in the rocks, as you go up, first one very resistant mineral will start recording tracks, and then another, and then another. And so by dating the ages, you can sort out the rate of uplift. And it's typically a centimeter per year. Fairly rapid. The third thing I'm proud of, because one prominent member of the Academy who is a famous glaciologist who's on TV all the time, Richard Alley, was telling me that he had to have his fast track detector. No, it's not fast track. It's a detector that we invented in which the patent has expired on, and he gets the service done. He didn't even know that I had invented it. But he lives on the Reading Prong, right in the center of Pennsylvania. Now, that is where they discovered very uranium-rich deposits under the surface, and with cracks in the rocks, radon, driven by convection, reaches the basements of homes, and then the first floor, and then the second floor. And so every home has the service where the device that was invented by us analyzes the counting rate of radon alpha tracks and reports back. So it's a fairly inexpensive service, but it's essential. Another place where it was used was at the Colorado and the tailings of the mining industry, where they were digging a lot of radioactive stuff out. Now, yeah.
Another little question on the history and
cross-fertilization.
Your fission tracks in geological mica and things remind me a bit of cosmic ray tracks and emulsions.
Yes.
Did the two fields evolve entirely independently? Was there any cross-fertilization?
Totally independently. Emulsion became obsolete fairly early. In fact, it was superseded by the spark chamber, the bubble chamber, and tracking chambers of various sorts. There's still some people with a small lab and no money that do that sort of thing. But let's face it, one Nobel Prize went for the use of the nuclear emulsion to discover the Pi meson. They were exposing a large area of photographic emulsion at the top of Mount Chocaltaya.
Well, that's why I ask. I thought it had come earlier, and I wonder if that had inspired a search in other media or whether that was not part of it.
You know, the people who did the first work, which Bob Walker discovered in Harwell in England, may have. I don't know the origin. What somebody wrote an editorial about the book that we had written and said it's really too bad that the Brits lost out because they should have persisted and they might have worked it out further and developed the etching and so forth and looked at some of the applications. Okay.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.